The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ledevis, and today I'm heavily medicated because I'm just getting over a bout of the swine flu. But despite that, my ever-effervescent co-host is joining me here today, a man who believes that the Graviton is Hasbro's latest transformer, Bill Hunt.
How are you doing?
Good.
You know, they were out of those at Walmart when I went in there.
Oh, really?
I
was gonna get one for the kids. Are you a big Transformer fan?
I was going to get a Graviton for him.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't mean to bash Hasbro, the good folks at Hasbro. I think they're great. They make Mr. Potato Head. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, and believe it or not, I'm collaborating with them now. I am the new human model for their latest toy design.
You're collaborating with Mr. Potato Head?
No, I'm collaborating with Hasbro.
Oh, okay.
I'm the new human model for their latest toy design, Mr. Potato Butt. Oh, come on. I thought that was funnier.
That was good. I'm holding back the laughter. I'm restraining myself.
So. All right. The title of today's program is It's All Relative, where we'll be talking about relativity, gravity, and when black holes collide. It sounds like it ought to be a trailer for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
In a world where black holes collide.
Yeah.
All right. And our guest today
wouldn't
is
be much of a world
Pablo
off,
Laguna.
Ahead.
Could you tell us a little bit about our guest today?
Yes. Professor Pablo Laguna is professor of physics and the director of the Center for Relativistic Astrophysics at Georgia Tech. He received his Bachelor of Science in Physics from the guy that can produce
Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana Iztapalapa, Mexico.
Oh, that was horrible.
No, all right.
Well, let's ask Pablo. How do you pronounce it, really?
How would you say it?
Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana Iztapalapa.
Bueno.
Yeah, he can do it.
All I can do is, yo quiero taco bell.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, you didn't even sound as good as the dog on the commercials.
I'm not as good looking either.
In 1981, in his PhD from the University of Texas at Austin in 1987, he was a professor at Penn State from 1992 to 2008, at which time he was recruited to Georgia Tech. He uses the very complicated equations of general relativity and some pretty scary computer programs called numerical modeling to study astrophysical phenomena where general relativistic effects play a fundamental role. Currently, he studies complex object pairs or binaries involving black holes
and neutron
stars. And
that would be you and me,
stars.
Complex object pairs?
No comment.
Okay.
Among other things, he tries to figure out what happens when black holes collide. I sat in on his class this semester in general theory of relativity, or GR, as the hip dudes call it. And
is that what the hip dudes call it?
They do, yeah.
You, and, baby, it's GR.
And I stuck with it until my brain exploded. Just fascinating stuff. He's an excellent teacher and researcher of a very complicated subject. Professor Laguna, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Thank
all right,
Bill.
Before we get into the heaviness of, what do you call it, GR? That's what
GR.
The young hipsters call it.
Yeah.
I just want to remind people that we have holding Adam Wathen, a graduate student in electrical and computer engineering, who's been working with a physics class at Cedar Grove High School.
Right, so it's Mr. Dandy Botla's physics class at Cedar Grove High School. They are in the wings here, so they'll be asking some questions as we go along here. And again, my graduate student Adam Wathen, who's a STEPS fellow from Georgia Tech, has been working with the class.
And that's in Ellenwood, Georgia, right? I think it is.
I guess so.
All right. What's the name of the teacher?
You would ask me that twice, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Mr. Dandy Botla.
Okay. So, Mr. Botla, we apologize in advance.
No, that's one word, Dandy Botla.
Mr. Dandy Botla, we apologize in advance for setting back the physics education of your class.
No,
a good three more months.
That's
what I'm saying.
Here we go.
All right. Before we get into when black holes collide, we'll begin the program with a segment we often do.
Science in the News.
And today's Science in the News article comes from today's New York Times, entitled A Takeoff and Hope for the Boeing Dreamliner by William Yardley. Apparently yesterday, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner lifted into the gray skies near Seattle for its first test flight. And a lot of people, at least in Seattle and at Boeing, are very excited about the fact that this is going to bring Boeing back to the forefront ahead of its competitor, Airbus. But scientifically, what's interesting about this particular thing, the Boeing 787 is designed to be 20% more more fuel efficient, quieter, and more comfortable than other commercial jets, and built for long-range flights. Excuse me. And the reason for that is because, unlike previous jets that Boeing has made here, the 787 is built from more plastic composites than metal, and is pieced together from parts made around the country and the world. Initially expected to fly in 2007, it has been plagued by production flaws. And
so it's basically recycled leisure suits.
Not necessarily. It may actually be what we like to call in the plastic industry virgin plastic.
Okay, all right.
Non-recycled. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so talking about the science and the technology part of it, I think it's a good illustration of the fact that it's hard to predict research and development. You know, you got guys in these blue pinstripe suits that want to schedule this. But when you suddenly switch over from aircraft aluminum, which is the mainstay of the commercial aircraft industry for many, many years, and now are making these out of the same plastic, ceramic, plastic, and what's it composites? Things like carbon fibers. I'm not even sure if you call it carbon fiber or a ceramic or a polymer or, you know.
Right.
You probably have some metals in there as well. The same sort of composites that, you know, Lance Armstrong's bicycle is made out of, as well as your tennis racket. Getting all those to glue together and stay together and work together is not a trivial thing. So I don't think it's necessarily such a bad issue. And Airbus is working on a composite plane as well, and that, too, has had some delays as
well. So part of it, you know, it's research in the engineering sense, or you're developing it. You're not just building the same old airplane. You're adding in some very different things about
it. Yeah, and if you can make it out of plastic, and you can make it lighter, it's going to increase fuel efficiency. For example, mechanical engineers, they've been looking at plastic engines for years. And if you think about it, what's the heaviest thing in your car, aside from Bill Hunt? That would be your engine. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so now are we going to start with callers from, are we going to start with Adam, with calls from the students?
Sure.
Do you want to start with calls? How do you want to start, Bill?
Sure, let's go ahead and
Pablo's getting ready to leave the studio as I speak.
No,
he's like, get me out of here. Crazy.
So are you there? Adam? Adam?
We're hoping that Adam's on the line.
Are you there?
Adam has fled.
I guess not.
I think
Adam
you hung up on
him. Fled the scene.
Maybe.
Call back.
All right, can I start with a question?
Sure.
Will you allow me to do that, Bill?
Sure.
You're a very gracious individual.
Yes.
I take back everything I said about you behind your back last week.
Yeah.
So we mentioned black holes. So what exactly is a black hole?
All right. So most of the celestial objects that we know, like the sun or the stars that we see in the sky, they are in equilibrium because it's a competition between gravity that tries to pull things inwards together and pressure that pushes it outwards.
Right.
So that's where they spend most of their lives. Like that. At some point, they run out of fuel, and gravity takes over. And as I'd like to say, at the end, gravity always wins. And
it certainly does with Bill.
I'm
feeling the pull from this side of the studio as we speak.
And there could be instances in which this lack of equilibrium could be restored, and that's where we have objects like a white dwarf that is an object of the size of the Earth, and but the gravity is much more stronger. Then we can have cases like a neutron star that is a size of about 10 miles in diameter. But then if you have enough mass that you cannot build the pressure to maintain the equilibrium, what happens is that the object keeps collapsing, and eventually what is going to happen is that at the surface, instantaneously at some point in the surface of this object, not even light could be able to escape. But the object keeps collapsing and forms what we call a singularity. And so a black hole is, to some extent, a simple object that has a singularity in which the physics that we know breaks down.
And a singularity, just to educate the general public, that's like a point. It just, you know, it gets such huge, almost an infinity of properties in a very small space. So we have singularities in electrical engineering, poles and zeros. And so it's a point where kind of the math blows up in a sense, or conventional mathematics
blows up. That's correct.
Right. I mean, so, and a lot of people think, well, singularities, I can't relate to this. And I think Trent, our discrete mathematics major, will back me up on this. Think of mathematical functions that suddenly go to zero, right? Whether it's a hyperbola or something like that, you suddenly have something with infinite slope, infinite curvature, right?
That is, to some extent, that's what we have.
And that's the simplified version.
That's right.
Yeah.
And at that point, for instance, we have infinite density.
Right.
We're packing, it could be a finite amount of mass, but in a volume that is so small that when you divide the mass over the volume,
right,
basically
right,
you have infinite density.
Right.
And if we look at it in terms of curvature, that is a better way to look at it under Einstein's theory of general relativity,
mm-hmm,
is a place in which you have infinite curvature.
Right. Of the space-time continuum.
Of the space-time.
Okay. Yeah, and one other word that was mentioned previously was equilibrium. So think of equilibrium as literally a balance.
Right.
Right. I mean, in physics and chemistry, we use equilibrium, but it's the balance between gravity and all this kinetic energy from the fusion furnace in a star.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Well, I think we're ready for, as soon as he queues up, we have the Cedar Grove guys there. You there?
Hello?
Adam?
Calling Adam.
Adam?
Nothing like 4 geeks in a studio trying to work the phone line.
Maybe they are behind the event horizon.
We will never see him.
Not even phonons can escape
from Cedar Grove High School, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay.
All right. Trent's scratching his chin.
So they're showing up as still being here.
He's giving us the universal symbol for Phil.
Yeah, Phil.
Okay. All right. So it looks on the board like they're here, but anyway. Well, let me ask some other. So you were at University of Texas at what would appear to be the same time as John Wheeler. Was he your advisor? Do you have classes with him? Or
right. John Wheeler spent most of his career in Princeton, and I believe that at that time Princeton had a retirement age limit.
Mm-hmm.
So University of Texas took the opportunity to hire him, and that's when I arrived in Texas in the early 80s, and I took a couple of classes with him, and he was a fantastic teacher, a fantastic mentor. He was not my supervisor, but I participated in some of his group meetings, and he had things that are unique at the way of teaching. For instance, one of the exams that I took, I mean, we walk into the classroom, and the exam already had the answers on it, and he said, look, what you have to do is you're going to grade the exam. The closer you get to the correct grade is going to be what is going to determine your grade. So we were actually grading the exam.
Wow.
And based on that. So he had extremely
That's very different. Yeah.
Innovative ideas. Mm-hmm. He also had this approach of that before you start going with all these complex mathematics to do mm-hmm. what you call it, the poor man approach. I guess if he would be now, he will be the poor person approach, to be politically correct.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also fantastic that you can, by back of the envelope, by mm-hmm. simple calculation, to be able to get deeper insight into the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I felt lucky to have taken a class with John Wheeler.
Yeah, and he was Richard Feynman's advisor and also Kip Thorne's advisor. And the guy, he died last year at the age of 96.
Wow.
And I think he had done a postdoc for Niels Bohr,
mm-hmm.
I believe.
Wow.
Yeah, the dude.
Bohr.
The dude
Bohr
goes back.
Radii.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
The dude
impressive.
Goes back. So he was doing a postdoc in the mid 30s.
Old school physics.
Very, very old school.
He was the one who came up with the name black hole.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Ah, okay.
He introduced the name black hole.
Okay. And my understanding was, didn't Oppenheimer do a lot of work on black holes as well?
Well, Oppenheimer had a. Well, besides being involved in Los Alamos mm-hmm. with the Manhattan Project, yes, indeed, he had was involvement in studies to see how an object that collapses could lead to the formation of a black hole.
Right. Okay.
So while we're waiting for the technical difficulties subside, I will ask you some questions that we were sent by Cedar Grove High School.
Cool.
The other option would be...
So that means they'll be good questions, unlike the ones we
questions.
Ask.
Right. one question here is gravity made up of any particles that help its strong pull? If so, what type of particles could obscure the structure of gravity?
All right, so the particle aspect is something that we're still, by we, I mean the community of research studying gravitation, they are still after. That is a quantum theory of gravity. In the same way that we have that with light, we can view photons as both particles and waves. The hope is that we eventually are going to be able to see gravitational waves. That is an effect directly related to gravity. And that was one of the predictions, or is one of the predictions of the Einstein's theory of general relativity, that we could also have a this dual character in which we have particles as well, but they have not been detected, and we still need a theory that account for this object that is gravitons. That would be the and now about the second question: if they, can you obscure? And then I guess I'm, the way I interpret obscure is to shield, or can you?
So an anti-gravity generator?
Yeah, that's what like the anti-gravity belt that you wear.
Right.
That it's not helping, but go ahead.
I know. Yeah.
Or with, for instance, positive or negative particles and electromagnetism that you can, in principle, shield.
Right.
With gravity, you cannot.
Okay. So the anti-gravity generator, even if we figure out gravitons and this whole wave-particle duality thing, we probably will not be able to create a anti-gravity generator that way?
Well, I mean, when we understand about counteracting the effects of gravity, what basically we're doing is we're adding pull from a direction opposite to the one that we want to counterbalance and give the effect that
of you no gravity.
Of no gravity. Yeah. But in the proper sense of positive particles, negative particles, to be able to achieve shielding the effects of the that one we don't have in gravity.
Okay. Wow. So, all right, do you got another question from the class?
Yes, yes. So, kind of related to that, can we produce gravity? So, in the future, is there potentially a way for a spaceship to contort gravity and have it propel the spaceship, for example?
Well, gravity, the way that Einstein introduced it to us is matter is the one responsible for the curvature of space-time, and that is the modern approach to what we view gravity. So the way to interpret this question is that as if you want to produce gravity or to curve space-time, what you need to do is to bring a massive object or energy.
Because they're interconvertible based on Einstein's
equation.
So in
the sense of producing gravity, I mean, you can take the pragmatic approach. As long as you produce mass, you will automatically bring gravity with it.
Okay.
Now, a black hole, you don't have to have mass in the proper sense that we understand. So you can also produce gravity if you are able to curve space-time.
Okay. So we don't think of a black hole as having mass.
Black hole, the way that that it's a little bit difficult to visualize, but a gravity, I mean, a black hole, it's just curvature of space-time. There is no mass.
But its curvature mimics the same gravity of the initial mass of the thing that collapsed.
Exactly.
Now you're freaking me out. Oh. Black holes have no mass?
Well, unlike Bill, who has significant mass.
No mass in the sense that we understand mass, but the effects are indistinguishable from an object, equivalent object that has that mass. For instance, if we substitute with a black hole our sun in the center of the solar system, from the gravitational point of view, it will be indistinguishable.
Yeah. Oh, as long as it was the same mass.
The same mass. So that is, in that sense, how you associate mass to a black hole.
Ah, okay.
It's through their gravitational effects.
And, I mean, you do this as a point calculations with Newton's gravitational law that, you know, as long as you're not inside the planet, you go to the center of that mass, and that's the black hole, which is now a single point. Wow.
And actually, that is how there is a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. And the way that the mass of this object or the detection of this object was done was precisely by monitoring the orbits of stars in the galactic center. By looking at those and applying, you don't even have to use Einstein's theory. You can apply just Newton's theory of gravity. And by looking at those orbits, you can infer what the central object is, the one that is causing that motion, and the mass is about 3 million solar masses. That is 3 million times the mass of our sun.
Ah, okay. So this is really just a centripetal force calculation that they're doing, right? I mean, they're doing torques and angular momentum to figure
out. Or applying, another way to put it, applying just Kepler's laws of...
Right.
But, I don't know anything about astrophysics other than you got to look up to see some of that stuff. But the structure of these galaxies, the pinwheel and all that... Is that driven by a black hole at the center? I mean, because I understand they don't necessarily, in their entire lifetime, they may not go through one entire
revolution.
Are most
spiral galaxies, do they have a black hole at the center?
Well, what I'm trying to get, is it that the sun or the stars in that are lined up along these lines within the space-time? Or, you know, is the black hole giving it its structure? Because it's not... moving fast enough to go through like revolution after revolution, right?
Right. So a black hole, no matter what its mass, it has a sphere of influence. Now, the sphere of influence of a supermassive black hole in the center of galaxies, there are many galaxies that have supermassive, is quite small. So those spiral arms that you refer to or the shapes is likely not to be directly connected to a black hole. Now, there is a correlation between the mass of the supermassive black hole in a given galaxy and the dynamics in what is called the bulge. The bulge is the inner part of the galaxy. But far away in where you see the spiral is likely not to be the case. So that is determined by other processes.
All right, let's see.
But you're on top of this, Bill.
I am. You can tell that. Right. How can a scientist determine whether gravity has increased or decreased? So this kind of gets to the question of how do you make measurements? If you don't know what the particle is, you don't have a graviton detector, how do you measure?
Well, I mean...
if it's increased or decreased.
I mean, one way... Again, I mean, it's typically, for instance, that some measurements about the mass of the planets in the solar system have been made by looking at the pull that given planet or moon has on satellites that we send. I mean, you need to have the interaction for this type of measurement between two objects.
So you basically use Newton's law. See how it changes the momentum of something going there.
And
so classically.
Then if you know one of the objects, then if you... apply that law, then you can have a good reading of the mass of the planet. And I was going to also make the joke that if you want to know if the mass has increased, I mean, for in the conventional laboratory, I mean, you just go and put a scale,
right?
And that what the weight is measuring. Directly the
gravitational force of the planet.
And if you put that scale in an elevator that is accelerating upwards, the gravitational pull will increase because you are adding to the one that the Earth has the acceleration that you're.
And then of course that mass changes as you approach the speed of light.
That's right. But so we have what is called the rest mass.
Right.
Okay. That is the one that you and I will measure if we are at rest relative to the object that we want to measure. And then there is the other one that we measure as this mass is moving. As it approaches the speed of light, that mass increases.
Right. And then it actually contracts as well, its dimensions.
That's right.
So I have a theory that, years from now when we can approach the speed of light, we won't have any supermodels. We'll just film people near the speed of light. They'll look much thinner. It's got
to
be good.
So then you won't have to worry about teenage girls, becoming anorexic. They'll just go at close to the speed of light, and their length will dilate, and then they'll think
they look
fine.
If you turn them on their side, maybe they get a little shorter.
The
aspect ratio.
Height,
All right. So before you go into another question, are black holes considered dark matter?
Well, there was one of the theories or one of the suggestions is that indeed that we had perhaps, since are difficult to detect, and maybe we have some population of black holes that will account for that. But I think last time I checked, that would be very, very difficult to account it could be a contribution to the dark matter, but not the dominant.
So it is a it is this gravitational effect that you cannot see in the classic sense of mass. But yeah, that's what I've heard, that it is only a small fraction of this matter that we don't think of as matter. We just see its effect in gravitational pull.
Exactly. Right. So we see the effect that this matter has in the motion of stars that are visible to us in the galaxy, or luminous matter in galaxies, but we don't directly detect this mass that that produces that dynamics, and we just don't know what it is yet.
Well, but the other thing, if you really think about it, almost every measurement that we make is really an inference.
Yeah, indirect.
I mean, electrical engineers, you know, we, you know, hook up some oscilloscope probes and look at a waveform on an oscilloscope, and we think we're seeing what's going on. You get kind of in, you know, indoctrinated. Wow, I'm seeing what this circuit's doing. You're just seeing how that probe interacted and how it drives you know, the printout on the, or the image on the screen, but there's still some level of inference in there, even with this. So it's data collected.
Yeah, we talked about that 2 weeks ago, that almost everything is indirectly made in one sense or another. Have you got another question? Because I have tons. I'm riveted by this topic.
Well, dive in, because we're still sort of trying to connect up with them.
Are we still trying to connect up to
Yeah, dive in.
Yeah. Okay. So, general relativity and special relativity. I mean, was this, you know, just Einstein realizing, well, I got to include gravity in this. I better go back to the drawing board.
So I said, that's not so special. So, okay, we'll make it.
You know, and then which one was it? Was well, first of all, what's the difference between general relativity and special relativity? Special relativity came first.
Right. So, I mean, if you think in terms of how we learn classical mechanics, so the special relativity will be the equivalent of talking about how the objects move at constant velocity, how the what you transform from one frame of reference to another one in which you're still moving at a constant velocity, and but you don't talk about yet the effects of gravity. So you don't introduce yet Newton's theory of gravity. So you can the first part, you can look at the what is called kinematics, or how objects move. And then move on later to what is dynamics, in which you include the effects of forces and so forth. So when Einstein, it's a similar sense. I mean, is that the special theory of relativity, you're talking about mostly, you know, objects, transformation of coordinate, between coordinate systems that move at a constant velocity. You can include acceleration, but not in the sense that we do it with gravity. Now, when you add gravity, that's when Einstein introduced the general theory of relativity, in which had to introduce the curvature of space-time as a way, a new way to see gravity.
Right.
So,
and his, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think his sort of central thought was that the speed of light is going to be the same to any observer.
That's right. So that's one of the postulates of the special theory of relativity.
Right, and then sort of almost everything else falls, and the laws of physics are the same?
That is correct. Actually, the motivation was that there were some problems with the theory of electromagnetism, as conceived by Maxwell and others, that if you follow the classical or the classical kinematics point of view, it could not be resolved. There were some paradox. And by introducing the special relativity, those were resolved in terms that the laws of physics are the same, independent of who applies or who observes those laws.
Well, I think we're finally...
Do we got Adam on the line?
I think so. You guys there?
Hello?
Hey!
Hey, Adam.
Wow.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Welcome to the 21st century.
We're glad you could make it.
Yeah, there we go. What a technology, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So, okay, yeah, we got a question here from KRL Cedar Grove. All ready?
Go ahead.
We're ready.
Closer to the phone.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the
program. You're on the air, dude.
Oh, thank you. My question to you all is, what makes stars be able to travel across time and space?
Okay, what was that again? What makes stars
be able to travel across or endure through time and space or travel across time and space?
Okay.
Travel across time and space.
Right.
Right. So, and it's the same way that what makes the Earth and the Moon and all the other planets to travel there. It's basically the conditions operating inside a galaxy. Galaxy, what we have in there is gas, dust, stars, planets, the Moon. And their motion is just a consequence of how that galaxy was put together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's not that there is an engine pushing the star. It's not that they have a way to, like a rocket, to eject gas and material in one particular direction. Mm-hmm. No, this is just a natural consequence about how the galaxy formed. And the rotation of the galaxy, the particular motion that each object in the galaxy is dictated about how is a consequence of how this galaxy was put together.
So Okay. Basically, the whole thing's moving in a trajectory, kind of like billiard balls, except the billiard balls can actually affect people via gravity, right?
Exactly. So there is obviously gravitational interaction between stars. I mean, actually, almost half of the stars that we see in the sky, they come in pairs. So they are feeling their own interaction. But the motion in space-time that we see in the large scale is dictated basically by the dynamics of the conditions that operate also as a whole inside the galaxy.
Right. Do we have another question?
Okay, is it true when there's a new moon that the gravity tends to affect people's emotions and actions?
Certainly affects Bill's emotions and actions.
Right, yeah.
There's a lot of howling during that phase of the moon.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Most of the effect that we see is in the tides, I mean, of the ocean. But I have heard that, and actually I own pets, and it's a little bit outside my area of research, and I would have known if there is enough evidence to see that that's the case.
But this whole interaction between physical forces and neurological forces is covered by a science called noetics. And noetics, if you guys read the Dan Brown novel, The Lost Symbol, talks about noetics a lot. And I don't know if noetics is a bunch of hooey or not, but it sounds very interesting. We are going to try to get someone from the Noetic Institute on the program sometime later in 2010.
Great. Excellent. All right. Next question.
Maya, I wanted to know exactly how are black holes created?
Oh, that's a good question.
All right, there are different ways. I mean, there are one type of black holes that were created when the universe was created. They're called primordial black holes. We believe that they have evaporated. They have vanished by now. There are other black holes such as the one that is at the center of our galaxy, that is a very, very massive, is about a few million times the mass of our sun. Those black holes that are called supermassive black holes, there's still not a clear understanding how you were able to put so much mass together in such a small volume that eventually collapsed to form a black hole. Okay. So those are still... It's puzzling to know, find out what happened. The ones that we have a better understanding are black holes that form from massive stars like the sun. What I mean by massive, about 8 to 20 times the mass of the sun. They have such a large amount of mass that when gravity takes over and start pulling all the material together, ones that is impossible to generate the heat that keeps the pressure going to counteract gravity, those collapse and form a black hole. All the mass goes, in, loosely speaking, into a single point in which you have such a high density that physics breaks down, and that so-called singularity is hidden from us with an event horizon. We cannot see that singularity.
So could it get bigger by, if you have a hole, big black hole of a certain size, will other stars start to fall into that black hole and become part of the black hole?
Absolutely. Actually, that is the lines of work that I do in the numerical simulations. What happens when a black hole interacts with other objects? It could interact just with gas. We can have the black holes swimming in a gas cloud, and it's swallowing that gas cloud, and as the mass disappears beyond the event horizon, it increases the mass of the black hole.
So once it draws it in, is it the same form of matter sort of as the black hole?
Well, that is related to what is called the loss of information paradox, and I think that could probably be a topic of a full program.
We'll
like this.
We'll skip
that one. But I mean, let's just say that once that the matter has crossed the event horizon, there is no way to find out what type of matter is inside. So, for practical purpose, the information about what the characteristics of the matter in that respect has been lost.
So you could tell that it's effectively more massive.
Right.
But you can't tell if now it's neutron star mixed in with, you don't know.
If unless I tell you that there was a neutron star or there was the Earth falling into a black hole, you will not be able to tell what the type of matter.
And it's not as though we can take a Voyager probe and push it down the throat of a black hole, because we communicate it via electromagnetic radiation, and that can't escape
either. That won't get out.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. You will be able to communicate up to the point in which the object crosses the event horizon.
Which is why we call them black holes, because light cannot escape. Not because it's, you know, slimming for fall or something like that.
Next question.
This is Alexis, and I wanted to know if one black hole could collide with another hole and what happened.
All right. So this is actually what you do your research on.
That's right.
And this is where I get to say, new this fall from TriStar Pictures, when black holes collide. I'm just waiting for the whole program.
Right.
I'm sure they're going to call you to do the trailer.
To write the screenplay.
Yeah.
Right. So when two black holes collide, it forms a black hole roughly with a mass that is the sum of the masses of the black holes that merge.
But you say roughly. When you say roughly, I think of lots of tensor calculus that you're skipping over here or something like that.
Right. No, the reason that I said roughly is because one of the fundamental predictions of Einstein's theory is that we have gravitational waves. Okay. And when I say roughly, is that about 3% or so, roughly a few percent of the mass of these black holes will be converted into black gravitational waves. And those will eventually be detected. Okay? Mm-hmm. So you have that if black hole 1 has a unit of mass and black hole 2 has another unit of mass, at the end what you get is not 2, but you get 1.95 or 96. Okay. And the rest comes in radiation in the form of gravitational waves.
Hmm.
Now, why is it that we invest a tremendous amount of resource, computational resources, and also, you know, students, postdocs on this? Because right now, United States has two observatories working, one of them in Washington State, the other one in Louisiana, in which these observatories are collecting data that hopefully soon in that data, we'll see indication of these gravitational waves coming from the merger of two black holes. Mm. That will be the first time that there is a direct detection of gravitational waves, and hopefully will confirm Einstein's theory of general relativity in the strong regime that is involving objects like black holes.
So other than the fact that I know they put a lot of these observatories way down in salt mines or something, how do you detect gravitational waves?
Okay. Well, these are actually they're in the surface, these detectors.
Okay.
They're called the LIGO detectors. There is another one in Italy and one in Germany, and hopefully very soon will be another one in Australia. So, but the rough idea is that what you want to a gravitational wave is a ripple in the fabric of space-time. That is what we tend to say.
Okay.
So if a gravitational wave is going through this room, what it's doing is changing the length changing both time and changing the dimensions of this room.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of these detectors, they're called interferometers. The idea is to detect how a gravitational wave changes the separation of the mirrors in this interferometer.
So I would see minor frequency misalignments in an interferometer.
Exactly.
Ah, okay.
Exactly.
So if I'm bouncing light back and forth, right? Depending on the space in between them, I can either get them constructively or destructively interfering.
Right.
If I actually change the space,
right.
which I can actually do, right?
Yeah.
But if it changes because of this ripple, I will see that in the light that's coming off of this thing.
That's right. So now there are many other sources of that could change that distance. I mean, for instance, seismic noise is one of the main things. That is why these are very, very difficult experiments.
So it's a precision issue.
And the data, the noise dominates the data.
Right.
And that is why the people involved in the data analysis, they need some guidance about what to expect. It could be signals, could be from black holes that collide. It could be from neutron stars, a supernova.
Mm-hmm.
There are other sources. And what the data analysis people need is to have some examples of those sources to see what to expect and to be able to dig out of these very noisy data the real signal.
So I was talking to Professor Laguna before the program about this, and it's very similar to getting a signal, radio signal from a satellite when that first started back in the 60s, all these things like Kalman filter and these other approaches are, if I know something about the character of the noise, I've got a shot at pulling the signal, characteristics of the noise and characteristics of the signal, I can pull it out of the noise. If I don't have any idea what the signal looks like, I've got no chance of pulling it out. So it's a similar, you know, if you start to know what is this signal going to look like in this mash of noise, is it, you know, a certain error covariance or whatever, then you can start to pull it out. So let's get the next question.
Oh, hi, I'm Nicolette. And my question is, I heard something in the news that maybe stars could breathe, it was reflecting the sun. So I was wondering, could stars breathe? And if they can, like, what is that? What are they actually doing?
So the creation of new stars, how do stars get created?
Oh,
is that correct? Breed? Yeah, so how do you create new stars?
Was it breed or breathe? Breed, right?
Was it breathe or breed?
No, breathe. B-R-E-A-T-H.
Okay,
breathe.
So the fluctuations
we're
of
the
star.
We're not even sure that Bill breathes.
Yeah,
but
we'll
take that question anyway.
Yes, there are stars that that show some pulsations. I mean, the suns show some also activity of pulsations, but other ones that they do more, there are other ones that actually have winds that eject material. So it's stars, not all of them are like the sun. I mean, and depending on the stage at which they are, they will exhibit different characteristics. I mean, at the end, when the sun fuel, when the keeps it at the way that we see it right now, when that fuel runs up, we'll see that the star will start puffing up. It will increase into what is called a red giant.
Okay, and, so this is a big inhalation for the star.
That's right. But there are other ones that we use to determine the distances to other galaxies. And these are stars that exhibit this type of pulsation or breathing, but it's more in terms of the luminosity, in terms of how bright they are.
Okay. Because, I mean, it's tough to measure the volume of a star if it's a giant ball of hot plasma gas, right? So I would see that luminosity would be a heck easier.
Right. Okay, next question.
Hello, my name is Shanice. My question was, is it possible to use a device from Earth to knock a big planet out of orbit like Jupiter?
Very unlikely. Jupiter is the object that dominates after the sun is the one that dominates the gravity in the solar system. Actually, if you want to calculate trajectories of other planets, you need to account for the gravity of Jupiter, among other things, because it's such a dominant object. Not as much as the sun, but so to deviate or to change the orbit of a planet, you need to provide enough energy that could be converted into what we call kinetic energy to change the trajectory there. And it is very unlikely that we have on the Earth enough energy. Yeah. We can do it through nuclear devices, but, I mean, it will be very unlikely to be able.
But even if you take the sum total of our nuclear arsenal and add up the total kinetic energy, assume it's 100% efficient at knocking, say, an asteroid. You know, when something the size of, you know, half the U.S. is coming at us at 35,000 miles an hour, you guys can make that calculation. And then you convert that to megatons, we're in deep doo-doo.
Well, if you think about, can you move it off track, that's one issue. But there was a series of comet fragments, I think, that collided with Jupiter a few years ago, and we certainly saw the evidence. So it created an effect on Jupiter, but it wasn't enough to knock it off its orbit, right?
But that's, I think that's actually a good question, because it points to the fact that Jupiter has a huge gravitational pull. Saturn, you know, these gas giants.
Rosie O'Donnell, for example, she's got a big gravitational pull.
Right. I can't believe no one's asked the 2012 question, right? So supposedly in 2012 we've got this alignment of planets on either sides of the sun. If we had that...
You're talking about my birthday, man.
Oh, that's right.
December 21st, 2012.
Yeah, that's it.
There you go. At my house.
Bill and the end of the world, they go together.
That's right.
But, I mean, if you think about it, that's not going to do much to the sun. Would it cause extra solar flare activity if all the planets were aligned on either side? I can't believe it would do much more than that.
Yeah, just my guess will be not.
Okay.
Not a whole lot.
But the special effects in the movie were good.
Yeah, it was really cool. All right, next question.
Yes, my name is Jay, and I would like to know what causes stars to die out.
All right, so...
You know, like Britney Spears, I think we've just had enough of her.
I think it's just bad PR.
That's bad PR. They had a bad agent.
So what happens is that stars are mostly made of hydrogen. Okay. So what you have is just you're burning that as a fuel. And eventually, the sun, or stars like the sun, they run out of that fuel, and that burning is the one that creates the pressure that counterbalances gravity.
Right, so poofs it up is the technical term.
Right, and gravity is trying to shrink the object, and they spend billions of years like that, but eventually, you know, the amount of fuel is finite, mm-hmm. and they run out of that, and that's how then you create an imbalance. Mm-hmm. Gravity takes over. You go through a series of stages in which fuel of different kinds is the one that are burning. Eventually, you run out of that. Mm-hmm. And at the end, you don't have anything else to burn. And what you go is into what is called a supernova explosion. And that supernova explosion can leave behind a white dwarf, an object the size of the Earth, with the strong gravity, the masses. A little less than the mass of the sun, but a neutron star or a black hole. So it's mostly what is called hydrostatic equilibrium, an equilibrium between pressure forces, the time to poof, and gravity, the time to...
Interesting.
Yeah, so hydrostatic pressure is the same thing that helps your toilet flush.
Right.
Let me ask you a quick question. Well, I'm a chemical engineer. All we do is plumbing, basically. But when you talk about white dwarfs and neutron stars, I mean, what I like to think about is you take a neutron star, you take a teaspoon of matter from a neutron star. Mm-hmm. What does that weigh? And doesn't that weigh like what Long Island weighs or something like that?
Yeah, okay. Yes. So it's
wouldn't that be cool?
It's extremely high densities that... cannot be reproduced in laboratories.
Yeah,
one of the challenges these days is to find what is called the equation of state applicable to neutron stars.
Okay, so the relationship between pressure and volume and temperature, essentially.
Right.
But basically what you've done, the reason this is possible is that if you think about atoms have mainly a lot of space between the electrons and the nuclei. If you squish all that space out, you know, then you can have That is feasible to have that sort of stuff. And I guess one other thing before we take the next question. When we're talking about burning, right? You think of hydrogen burning, and we think of hydrogen, you put it in the hydrogen-powered vehicle, and you mix it with oxygen, and you oxidize it to water. Not quite that kind of burning. What we're talking about is nuclear fusion, where the hydrogens go together, and they make bigger and bigger atoms. And as you do that, the energy difference between those atoms, you're releasing more and more energy, and that's where this stuff is coming from.
Right.
So,
okay, let's take another question.
Yes, my name is Shanice, and I wanted to know, why is gravity stronger on Earth than in any other place?
Well, it depends if you're standing next to Bill.
Yeah.
It's really, really strong.
Yeah, well, it depends of the compactness of the object. Let me explain what compactness means. It's the amount of mass that you're able to put in a given volume. For instance, the Earth has whatever mass it has, mm-hmm. in a volume of a spherical volume of a radius of about a few thousand miles. And that determines the gravity. The ratio or the of the mass to the size of the object. Now, the moon has a smaller volume, but also has a smaller mass, and it's that ratio of the size of the moon that determines the gravity also on the surface of the moon. The gravity in the sun is larger than the gravity on the Earth, so it is not only how much mass you have, but also how much mass is contained in a given volume.
Yeah.
Where you are.
So it depends on the radius.
Another
as well.
Part of this question is we feel most strongly here on Earth, the gravity of Earth, and yet there's a lot more gravity from the sun, but do we really feel it very much? Do we feel the moon a little bit because of the tides?
Right.
So I think maybe that's also part of this question is why don't we feel a black hole that's at the center of the galaxy?
It is because it's precisely that, related to the distance to the object. I mean, if you go to Newton's law of gravity, the force that we experience is inversely proportional to the distance square.
Right.
So here we can visualize that on Earth we are at certain distance to the center of the Earth.
Right.
Okay. But we are the distance to the moon is much, much larger.
Right.
So the effects are,
and it's R squared on
right.
the bottom.
Right.
So if we've got a black hole at the center of the galaxy is a million times bigger, that 1/r² thing is making that million really, really small by the time it gets to Earth.
Right,
so so it's
right.
the inverse square law, as they say.
And so the rule, which was mm-hmm. classical, that Newton came up with, was simply, you know, this gravitational constant G times the mass, the product of the mass of the two objects divided by R squared. So if you want to do this, you take G, which Newton actually calculated reasonably accurately mm-hmm. back then, but we've updated a little since. You put in the mass of the Earth, you put in the mass of that person, you do the R squared, and you can get this 9.8 meters per second squared acceleration on the mm-hmm. surface of the Earth. And that's actually a mm-hmm. very interesting question. Say you go to Jupiter, mm-hmm. a gas mm-hmm. giant. Mm-hmm. So Jupiter, much bigger mass, mm-hmm. but also a much bigger radius. So mm-hmm. it won't go exactly as just the mass because you're
the
further
density
away.
Is different, right? Yeah.
Because I never thought about it that way. But let me ask you a question. If it's a gas giant, what is the density of the surface?
You will sink.
Yeah, so how many miles will you sink till it gets dense enough to stop you? And I realize no one may have ever bothered to calculate that.
But you're going to sink in Jupiter?
But I thought you would sink. Yeah, because Jupiter's a big ball of gas.
Yes.
Yeah.
But eventually the gas will be so compressed near the center,
it crush
you'll
your,
stop somewhere.
It crush your bald head like a melon ball.
Absolutely. That's my wife
like
wants to do that every day.
Be like a Gallagher show, you know, with the watermelon.
But no, that's a good thing. You would sink. I always suspected you would.
Yeah.
So actually you'd have to figure out where you'd equilibrate.
Right.
Somewhere in the muck
that's
of Jupiter.
Great.
We'll work on
good question. Next question.
Hello, my name is Michelle, and I would like to know: has any scientist ever figured out what is actually in a black hole?
Excellent question.
We're thinking of launching Bill into one just as a probe, but we don't have the institute.
I'm not real good at sending postcards, though, so they probably wouldn't expect anything back.
So. Okay, so according to what we know about black holes, and both from the theory and the observations that we have, we believe that inside of a black hole there is nothing but just curvature and this singularity with everything ends up. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything that falls into a... So A black hole, as we like to say, has basically three hairs, you know, that is mass, mm-hmm. they could be charge,
okay,
and spin. So those are mm-hmm. the only three quantities that characterize a black hole. Now, for astrophysical purposes, we believe that charged black holes are likely not be common in the universe. Maybe it's difficult to separate charges in the universe in such a way that, mm-hmm. that you will keep a black hole charge with right. a given. So it's mostly two characteristics, mass, and that mass is associated to the gravitational pull there, and the other one is how fast or how slow they spin, and that's about it.
It's kind of unknown. So it's not like you could go in there and go, oh, well, there's some iron over here and some silicon over here and some.
But if they're all in one point, what does it matter? They're all
right. But that's what I'm saying.
Squished.
It's not like chemistry just sort of falls apart at that point. What's in here and what's salt now in a black hole? Yeah. Totally gone. Yeah. It's just a total different form of matter.
If you cross the horizon of a black hole, you have very little time left before you hit the singularity. So it's not that there's things orbiting there.
But as you hit the singularity, the gradient, the rate mm-hmm. of change with distance of gravity would be so great. Wouldn't it tear most matter apart?
It depends. I mean, if you fall into a black hole of a small mass, these tidal forces, mm-hmm. this is what you're referring, they will likely destroy you. But if for a large black hole, you can survive a little longer.
Okay. So we're trying to figure, can we ask one? Get one last question?
I guess we
could
do one more.
One last question.
Hello?
Hi.
Okay, I'm Raven, and I was just wondering about the 2012 situation. Like in the movie, like the Earth got turned over by floods, is that more likely than the sun imploding?
What happens in the movie?
In the movie, it's a little crazy. The crust gets destabilized because the core gets heated because of solar flare activity. But supposedly the crust – okay, let me explain it the way I understood it from the movie. The cross-sectional area for scattering and absorption of neutrinos magically increased, right? And we've actually had one of your colleagues from physics over here talking about the one – cubic kilometer detector at the mm-hmm. South Pole, where they get a few neutrinos a year that they can detect, because a neutrino has such a small mm-hmm. scattering crossing, it goes right through the planet most mm-hmm. of the time. So imagine if all those neutrinos that went through magically did impart their energy to the core, you could heat up the core and destabilize the crust. But that would basically take a violation of the laws of physics. So I don't think that's ever going to happen, no matter how much solar flare activity.
Some of these movies, they have good scientific consultants, and some of them they don't.
Yeah, that one was not that good. But the red giant phase of the Earth, that's going to mm-hmm. happen in what? Is it about 2 billion years?
Well, that red giant will happen in the sun.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
When it goes through its red giant phase,
It will swallow the entire solar system.
But they have a prediction for that, and that you can pretty much take to the bank, plus or minus maybe a few percent.
Right. So the stars like the sun, you know, they live a few billion years.
Years from now.
So we don't have to worry too much right now.
And then shortly after that, we're going to collide with the Andromeda Galaxy. So we better figure out intergalactic travel before then.
That shouldn't keep people from fixing healthcare, you know.
Yeah,
there you
right.
have it, ladies
that's
and
right.
gentlemen.
You still got to change your oil on that old car you've got, okay?
So thanks so much to Adam and the folks at Cedar Grove and their teacher. What's their teacher's name again?
Something unpronounceable.
Poor, underpaid college of ours in the educational field.
Mr. Dandy Boatla.
All right, thanks so much to the folks out at Cedar Grove. We've reached the point in the program where we attempt to discuss what have we learned. We've learned so much. I didn't know that most stars were in twin systems, paired systems, so I thought that was really interesting. Yeah. We learned how black holes are formed, that there's three different ways they can actually be formed.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ones from exploding stars, the primordial ones, right?
I learned that we don't really know what's in there. I mean, neutron star, you've got some concept of what's making it up.
Yeah.
It's
atoms
like,
with the space squished.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
but that's
great
okay,
stuff.
Right? Because it is science. It's okay to do that. And then I learned yet another important use for computational science, mm-hmm. right? Which is exactly what our guest Pablo Laguna does. trying to do the simulations of how gravity waves would be observed and effective so that the people that are trying to detect these things know what they're looking for.
Right.
And they can filter out exactly what Bill talked about, the noise, that sort of stuff.
Right.
All right, I even learned the difference between general relativity and special relativity, that the best analogy to use is Newton, right? When he first talked about kinematics before he actually put in gravity, right? It's the stage kind of thing.
Right.
I also learned that, and this is something I always suspected, that although we can consider black holes dark matter, they only represent a small part of what's needed to explain this extra mass, keeping the universe from moving as if it would if there wasn't all that mass around. All right, what did I miss, Bill? I must have something.
You missed the question about why your kids only gave you H1N1 for Christmas and not like a tie or, you know,
that was my
pipe cleaner statue or something like that.
Dad appreciates that.
Yeah,
But I will say this, and we ought to talk about the Tamiflu. We talked about those. I was on Tamiflu. It seemed to work reasonably well.
Really?
That's a particular kind of receptor inhibitor that we've talked about before. Maybe we should actually do.
Thank Professor Laguna so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for
it's been
having
very
me.
Instructive.
Yeah, this was really great.
Yeah.
All right, just a reminder that next week we'll be talking to voting activist Bernie Ellis on a show entitled The Logic of Voting. He's been on the program before talking about electronic voting machines, and we're getting an update on that issue and some crazy things that are happening in Tennessee.
Crazy Gestapo things that are happening in Tennessee.
But if you've got a question or comment about today's program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. This program has been a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta. Science, only funnier.